This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
In terms of tradition, we have three types of tradition. The first is Quran, which is, we believe, is wahi, revelation from God, spoken through the Prophet ﷺ from Gabriel or Jibreel. And then the second type is also revelation, but it is spoken through the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ, and it is called hadith. And this means that the Prophet ﷺ is speaking inspired. He is inspired by God. مَا يَنْتَقُ عَنِ الْهَوَىٰ لَا يَنْتَقُ عَنِ الْهَوَىٰ إِنْ هُوَ إِلَّا وَحْيٌ يُوحَىٰ. That the Prophet does not speak from his own passion. This is revelation coming to him. So even his hadith is revelation. We believe that. And that is why you won't find any table talk. You won't find any trite conversation. You won't find any vulgarities in the hadith. All of the hadith have meaning and implication for the lives of Muslims. Now the hadith are divided into three basic essential types. Ahad, which are narrated by solitary transmitters, 1, 2, 3, 4, those have less strength. And then there is mutawatir, which is multiply narrated transmissions. If it is mutawatir, and there are only a few hundred of them, then those have the same status as the Quran in terms of absolute belief that they are from the Prophet ﷺ, and you should not reject them. An example of that is Naha Rasulullah ﷺ عن قتل النساء والصبيان. The Prophet prohibited the killing of children and women in war. That is multiply transmitted. There are so many narrations that it is impossible for that to be a mistake. And that is why that is agreed upon by the scholars. That it is prohibited to kill women and children in any types of martial conflict. And then the final is called a hadith qudsi, which is revelation from God, but the Prophet ﷺ transmits it as a hadith. And this is hadith qudsi. It does not have the same status of Quran in that we cannot recite it in the prayer. But we believe that it's also directly from God. And an example of that is أَصِيَامُ لِي وَأَنَا أَجْزِي بِهِ كُلُّ عَمْلِ إِبْنِ آدَمْ إِلَّا صِيَامْ. God says, according to the Prophet ﷺ, every action is for the son of Adam except for fasting. It is mine alone. Because Allah is the only one that does not eat and drink in reality. So when you fast, you're doing an action that is really, it's a way of, in a sense, it's the closest thing that we do that has a divine quality. Because only God does not eat and drink. We all need to eat and drink. That's one interpretation. There are many others. We also believe that the Quran is eternal and uncreated. And that means the meanings of the Quran. In other words, it's not the literal words in the book, but we only say that when we teach. We still say the Quran is uncreated, and that includes this book. We believe that the Quran, what's between these two covers, is the uncreated word of God. So we can say that, but we have an understanding that when we say that, it doesn't literally mean the letters and the ink. It's the meanings that those words convey. On page 24, they mention about Sayyidina Ali radiallahu anhu not giving up his claim. They're giving a Shia perspective that is not a Sunni perspective. We believe that Imam Ali radiallahu anhu, in fact, took bay'ah with Abu Bakr, which he says there, and the Shia admit that. But we believe that he took it believing that Abu Bakr was the rightly guided Khalifa and that Abu Bakr was better than Ali. And there is a hadith in Sahih al-Bukhari in which Sayyidina Ali says clearly that Abu Bakr was better than him, and so was Umar. Another important thing which they mention here is that generally the Muslims lived with many different religions. They did not persecute religions. There are a few instances, it does occur, but they were always rejected by the scholars, and they were also clearly done by rulers that were manipulating situations for their own political advantage, short-sightedness that led to a lot of problems. But Muslims generally treated other religions very well, kept their churches, synagogues, and temples intact, including the Zoroastrians and the Hindus and the Buddhists. Afghanistan, which was a very, very profoundly Buddhist country before the Muslims got there, the Afghanis converted from Buddhism, and some of the greatest Muslims came out of that Buddhist tradition. In fact, Balkh was a center for Buddhist logic, and those logicians became Muslim and introduced interestingly enough, into Islamic theology, some Buddhist logical formations that don't exist in Greek logic. The Greek logic doesn't have a neither A nor B type scenario, whereas Nagarjunan logic, which is Buddhist logic, does. In traditional Islamic theology, you have situations where they do have that, neither A nor B. And that definitely, I would say, I mean, I can't say definitely, but I really believe that it does come out of the influence that the Buddhist logicians had on Islam. I actually wrote a paper called How the Buddha Saved Islam, which was about that, but I sent it in to publish it, but somebody said, no, you'll get too much flack. Another thing which is important is generally the Muslim rulers did not want people to become Muslim. And the reason they didn't want them to become Muslim is because they lost tax revenue and they also had to deal with the egalitarian nature of Islam. So that's a fact. If you don't believe that, if you have some kind of romantic utopian version of Islam, it's a fantasy. All you have to do is read history. The Muslims were very honest in their history. You actually had to join an Arab tribe to become a Muslim. And the person that ended that was Umar ibn Abdul Aziz during Bani Umayyah. Before that, you literally had to join an Arab tribe. You had to become, and you were a mawla, which was an inferior position. And there is a movement in Iraq called the Shu'ubiyya, which means the people's movement or the popular movement. And these were all non-Arabs that finally got fed up and actually went into this revolt against it. So there was problems early on. There was ethnic problems, tribal problems. It's human condition. The beauty of Islam is that it was always redressing. And the ulama were always redressing these problems. That's what I love about Islam. You have in this country, 100 years ago, rabbis and priests writing treatises that black slavery was biblically sanctioned. And you can find that, I guarantee you, you can look it up in books on slavery in this country. Muslims have never had that. We don't have a history ever of our ulama justifying oppression textually. It just doesn't exist. On the contrary, I mean, they really wrote vehemently against those things. And Al-Jahil wrote a book about the preference of blacks over whites because he was a black man. And it wasn't the preference, but it was more that if you really look historically, there's a lot more great black people than there are white people. And he's got a whole book to prove it. And there's a beautiful book by Ibn al-Jawzi called Tanwir al-Ghabash an Fada'il al-Sudan wal-Habash, removing any darkness concerning the virtues of black people and Ethiopians. And this was an Iraqi imam that wrote an entire book showing all the virtues of black people. And one of the things that he says in that book is that anybody that narrates the Israeli view that blacks were the accursed descendants of Ham, there is no textual basis for that. And the Quran rejects that. And then he says the reason blacks are dark-skinned is because they've been living so long in the southern hemisphere that they have developed protective skin from the rays of the sun. He actually says that. Gives a scientific analysis, which is generally what people believe now. Is there any questions or comments? We are not supposed to interpret the Quran, but we are supposed to reflect upon its meanings. Please clarify. A great deal of the Quran is about reflection. أَفَرَا يَنْظُرُونَ إِلَى الْإِبْرِ كَيْفَ خُلِقَتْ وَإِلَى السَّمَاءِ كَيْفَ رُفِعَتْ وَإِلَى الْجِبَارِ كَيْفَ صُطِحَتْ وَإِلَى الْأَرْضِ وَإِلَى الْجِبَارِ كَيْفَ نُصِبَتْ وَإِلَى الْأَرْضِ كَيْفَ سُطِحَتْ فَذِكِّرْ. Haven't they looked at the camel, how it was created? Haven't they looked at the heavens, how they've been raised up? Haven't they looked at the mountains, how they've been placed, standing firm? Haven't they looked at the earth and how we have stretched it out? So remind them. Those are things to think about. Anybody, you don't need to interpret those verses. They're very clear. Much of the Quran is very clear. However, when the Quran says something like, if you fear disobedience or recalcitrance from your spouse, then warn her, abandon the bed, and then strike her, you're not allowed to interpret that. It is haram for you to interpret that, nor can you apply that ruling in your house. because it's in the Quran. It is haram for you to do that. Muslims have always believed that. You need to ask scholars the interpretation of that verse, and then you're surprised to find out it actually doesn't mean what you probably thought it meant. And that's what I mean by not interpreting the Quran. Those are the verses that deal with actual behavior. In those verses, you must go to scholars because you might completely misunderstand it. For instance, ghiba. The Quran says, لا يقتل بعضكم بعضا. Don't let some of you backbite about others. You have to understand there's a ruling. There's seven situations in which that law does not apply. Then you have to know the definition of backbiting. You might think it means speaking about things that aren't true. On the contrary, it means things that are true. So you have to understand, and that comes from scholars. It comes from people that understand the Quran. So that's what I mean. But verses in the Quran that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, إِنَّ فِي خَلْقِ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ وَاخْتِلَافِ اللَّيْلِ وَالنَّهَارِ لَآيَاتٍ لِأُولِي الْأَلْبَابِ, that in the creation of the heavens and the earth, alternating of the night and the day are signs for people who have deep reflection, people of innermost core. You can reflect on that. I mean, the Quran's filled with things, so you can read it for that. Don't try to derive rulings from it. That's all. That's all it means. Don't derive rulings. It's very important. Anything else? Normative is what the religion says about itself. It's not telling you how Muslims behave. It's telling you how they're supposed to behave. And that is a much fairer way of looking at a religion, is to look at the ideal and not the reality. So Sayyid Hussein Nasr wrote a book called Islam, Ideals and Realities. In every tradition, you have ideals and you have realities. America has an ideal, freedom, liberty, and justice for all. That's a beautiful ideal. We can all agree with that. Unfortunately, that has not been the reality of America. Intelligent Americans are the first to admit that, but there does seem to be an attempt, and certainly the Civil War is an example of that, the freeing of the slaves in this country, the civil rights. It's taken a long time to get to things that Islam arrived at 1400 years ago, but there's an effort. So ideals and realities are very different. The Geneva Convention is beautiful ideals about how to treat prisoners of war. The reality is, prisoners of war are treated like animals and worse than animals all the time. And sensory deprivation is torture. It's called passive torture, and it actually drives people insane. In some Christian texts, it says descendants of Isaac were great people and descendants of Ishmael caused great havoc on the earth. Not true. There's good in both the sons. And there's some bad offspring that came out of there, but you can't blame the parents for what. You can sometimes blame them for what their children do, if they were neglectful. But you can't blame them for what their grandchildren do. That's not their fault.